Okay, folks, we're just past the 7:30, so we'll go ahead and get started. Welcome any new people with us tonight. If you want to join the group, I pasted it into the chat where you can go to join up, and or you can just go to our homepage and click on the Join or Renew link at the top. It's just $20 a year, and we'd be happy to have you join us as a member. And so I think that's it for announcements, and so I'm going to mute all. As usual, everybody has the ability to unmute themselves. If you do so, please remute yourself after you ask a question or make a comment so that we keep background noise to a minimum. And later on tonight, Alan will be posting the entire contents of the deck in PDF format, the chat window, as well as the audio track to our website. And if you want announcements about when that actually occurs, you might want to sign up for the forum, so the member forum. Alan always posts to that when he actually gets it posted, all the files posted to our website. And with that, I'll turn it over to Alan to lead us through tonight's deck.
So that must be one of the major benefits of being a club member. You find out when the deck gets posted.
That's right.
Okay. All right. Thanks very much, Chris, and good evening, everyone. Now, we have quite a mixed bag of stuff, as usual, so let's get to it. And it wouldn't be Q&A if we weren't going to talk about extended security update. Yay! So everybody is probably aware by now that end of life for Windows 10 was nominally yesterday, October the 14th. However, it turns out Patch Tuesday was also yesterday, and a whole raft of updates arrived. And Chris pointed out that there wouldn't be any more updates for another month, i.e. the next Patch Tuesday. So really, end of life doesn't make any difference until November. So we have four more weeks basically before Windows 10 really reaches end of life. Anyway, my question is, have you enrolled for the extended security updates yet? And in fact, have you been offered enrollment? And if you haven't, if you're in the same boat as me until very, very recently, there may be a reason for that. And basically, I don't use Windows 10 that often. I do most of my computing with it. But when I do run Windows 10, I use a regular user's account. And I've set my system to be on a metered connection. It really isn't, but I told Windows it was, so I'm not bugged with updates when I don't want them. So I basically check Windows Update manually once I log into Windows. And this is what I see. It will, maybe download some stuff, but typically it will tell me that my system is up to date. But if you look around that dialog box, you'll find that it says nothing about extended security updates. And it's been doing that for months. I've been waiting for this thing to say, your machine doesn't support Windows 11, but you can enroll for this wonderful ESU program. But it basically never happened. However, last month, my Windows update got itself stuck in a loop, and it would download an antivirus update, it would download the malware software removal tool, it would install them, it would tell me it was up to date, and the next time I ran Windows update, I got exactly the same antivirus and software removal tool updates downloading and installing. So it just went round and round, and so I checked to see what I could do, and one of the suggestions was log in as an administrator and do some things. So when I logged in as an administrator, I actually saw this screen. My Windows system is up to date, but you notice now in the red box that I'm eligible for the extended security update program. So I've never heard anybody complain of this happening to them, but that has been my experience. If I'm a regular user, I don't see it. If I log in as an admin, which I suspect most people use an admin account, then I'm offered the ESU program. Now, it turns out when I did that, if you recall, Chris had mentioned enrolling I think it was Linda's machine, and he got this kind of screen which says, as you're already backed up your Windows settings, you're eligible to enroll at no cost. However, like Chris, I hadn't actually backed up anything. And in fact, when I logged on, Windows offered me the opportunity to back things up, and I said, no thanks. And then I did some more, and it offered me again to back things up, and I said, no, I really don't want to do that. But as you see, when I log in as the admin, somehow I'm already backing things up. Got no idea what that means, but anyway, I just followed the bouncing ball. I enrolled for the thing, and sure enough, I'm now enrolled in the ESU program through October 2026. And sure enough, when I go back to Windows Update, it says your PC is enrolled to get extended security updates. So all is good. Now, the thing is, if you remember, when you enroll one machine in Windows Update, in the ESU program, you actually get licenses for 10 machines. So I logged on with another machine. So here we are in a galaxy far, far away. And on my other computer, you can see that it says your device is no longer receiving security updates. So this was actually today. End of life was yesterday. So now this machine is not enrolled for ESU, and it's not going to receive updates. But 5 seconds later, updates are available, and they start pouring in, downloading and installing, and Patch Tuesday is working at its finest. So I find Microsoft very confusing. They say one thing and do another, and they do that quite frequently, I think. Anyway, I let it run, and then I tried logging in as an admin in this second computer, and sure enough, it says that my version of Windows has reached end of support, but I'm unable to enroll as into the ESU program. So remember, this is my second computer now that I'm trying to enroll. So I say, okay, let's enroll now. And I follow the prompts, do this next, and all the rest of it. I have to sign in with a Microsoft account. Right, fine, that's good. And now what it says is, add this device to receive extended updates. Right? I've already enrolled one machine, and it knows that my Microsoft account has one machine already enrolled. So now it just says, do you want to add this one to the list, as it were? So I say, sure, add the device. Off we go. And now this device, the second computer, is now enrolled for the ESU program. And sure enough, when I go back to Windows Update, my second machine now says it's enrolled for extended security updates. So Microsoft has done the trick. It also did another trick, which I'm not showing any slides about, but it changed my admin account. Both my regular account, which is a local user account, and my admin account, they're both local accounts. Once I enrolled for the ESU program, Windows changed my admin account to be a Microsoft account, to be my Microsoft account. It didn't ask me whether I wanted to do that, it just did it. Now, as Chris noted to me, I can actually change that. And my question is, why do I have to? Sometimes I wish that Windows had just gone to end of life and I could have just moved to Linux and made my life eminently simpler.
Anyway, I think I think it's really unconscionable for Microsoft to pull these stunts like this. First off, well, I think the reason why everybody is getting this, oh, because you're backing up your settings, you're enrolled automatically, no cost. I think that Microsoft was just getting such flack about this whole thing. They decided, well, let's do away with it, and we're not going to charge people $30. We're not going to make them come up with 1,000 points. We will just enroll them automatically, and I think that's it. But them changing your local admin account to a Microsoft account, I think that's inexcusable. And most people would never even realize that. Now, most people, I think, are actually better served by having a Microsoft account rather than a local account. But regardless, they shouldn't be screwing around with accounts like that.
Yeah, the other thing that changes is the icon that shows up on the splash screen. So you should know that something's happened. Anyway, there we go. What can I say? Right, next up, hopefully that's the end of the ESU program for a long time. Let's find out. Okay, next up we have Chris with a share on something completely different.
Okay, and you're going to give me slide control?
I will do that.
Okay, thanks. Okay, this is something I came across. It was kind of interesting. I think it's kind of neat. I don't actually use my phone for this sort of stuff at all, but I decided to try it out, and I think they did a really good job on this. So it's Hux AI, and paste that into the chat. So it's an audio-centric news app, and they have an app for both Android and iOS, and what you do is when you set it up, you specify your areas of interest. They have all kinds of them listed there. There's dozens and dozens of them that you can list as areas of interest. And then if you want, you can put in a location, which will allow them to tailor the output for more local stuff rather than getting, you know, say you're interested in sports. Well, if you know, you want South Africa sports or you want Ottawa sports sort of thing. So, you know, by adding in the location, maybe you'll end up with things that are more relevant to you. Optionally, you can allow it to connect to your calendar and or your email to get latest updates on that, and I'll give an example of that in a bit. And then what they do is they provide a daily audio news brief made specifically for you according to the topics that you actually specify. And it actually sounds like two human beings talking about whatever it is that is in the news. So it can dig into your calendar items for the day, and the whole thing is very conversational. So these are actual quotes out of, you know, what they came up with from mine. So, you know, it was, for the CIRA AGM this morning, there should be documents about the AGM available on the CIRA site, which I thought was interesting because I don't have any emails or calendar items that actually talked about getting the documents on the CIRA site, but they were actually right. Then they said you have some tech meetings in the afternoon and evening. This morning, remember to pick up your prescription. You can fit it in before the CIRA AGM at 1 p.m., which will be held virtually, and a reminder that registration is required. A little bit late to remind about registration, but nevertheless, very interesting. And then they went on and said in the evening, your weekly Q&A session begins at 7:30 and goes until 8:30 p.m. So, you know, really, really quite good in the way it sort of listed out, you know, what's important on my calendar. And then it went into my emails because I did give it permission to access my emails. And it noted that there's security notification from Google about Hux Access because when I gave Hux Access to my Google account, of course, I got an email saying that, you know, Hux has access. And if you didn't need to do this, you know, take action. And so they said no action is needed as long as it was me that really gave that access. Then I went into other emails that I had from that day, an email from Linda talking about a planned photo outing, and then it confirmed that Expedia confirmed a reservation that I have for a vacation in Saint-Martin. So very, very cool the way it just sort of reads these things out in a very conversational manner. I think it gets even better. You can adjust the speed of the podcast from anywhere from 1x to 3x. So if you want things speeded up, no problem. And another interesting thing, while your personal podcast is playing, so say they're playing a news item, you can actually tap the microphone icon, interrupt it, and ask questions about something that is going on in that particular newscast and get clarification or more deep information or whatever, anything at all. They actually stop, and then I guess it goes off. It figures out how to respond properly, and then it responds as if they were actually chatting with you. Really kind of cool. And then the podcast just continues on from there. So you get all the news in the categories you said you were interested in. They have a number of articles will always come up. So it starts with a list of all of the items that it's going to cover. Then it'll go in and it'll zoom in on each story as the podcasters talk about the particular item. And then after your news feed, you can scroll to listen to additional items that they have. There are controls at the bottom where you can stop them, ask for clarification, ask for reference materials, anything you want like that. Paragraphs get highlighted as they're read out to you. So all in all, I think it's a pretty cool item. I don't really use it, but that's the way I don't use my phone for things like this. But if you're of that type that you would like to have something read out to you like that, it's actually very, very well done, and it's free.
That's neat. Okay, before you go on, Chris, Richard has a question, our friend from Australia.
Yeah. Just a comment about that Microsoft update and forcing you to log into a Microsoft account. Check to make sure I've been avoiding that, because when you set up the Microsoft account, it changes the documents and pictures folders, puts them into the cloud.
Oh God, I didn't think that happened at the at that point, but it doesn't actually surprise me now that you mentioned that. That's nasty, because undoing that is a pain.
That's one of the reasons why I avoided having a Microsoft account when setting up logins.
It can be rolled back, but it's a pain to roll it back.
Yeah. Oh, it's a real nightmare, because I've got a friend that's got a sort of pictures account that's so well over 5 gigabytes.
Didn't do that to mine. My pictures and documents and videos and stuff are all exactly where I put them.
No. Did you happen to have uninstalled OneDrive? Or disabled it?
I disabled it, yeah. I don't use it at all.
Okay, if it's been disabled,
I just turned it into a cloud storage drive.
Yeah. Hmm. If the OneDrive app has been disabled, then it can't do that synchronization. So I would presume that's why you didn't get it. But, yeah, we should probably put together a couple slides for a future thing on talking about that conversion over to OneDrive, because it's a real pain for sure.
Yeah, it might be an idea to check that it doesn't automatically re-enable OneDrive.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, the other thing is,
I had those same messages come up on my machines. Literally, an update came through yesterday.
You can move your pictures and documents folders to a different place. You don't have to accept the defaults.
Yeah, so that's one of the little wrinkles of, logging into a Microsoft account that I found in the past. It's put them into the cloud.
I have found that does prevent the ESU from going through is if one machine hasn't been activated, if it doesn't have a valid product key.
Oh, yeah, I could see that, yeah. Hmm.
Harvey says you should unlink from your PC. I think he means OneDrive.
Yeah, OneDrive app, unlink it from the PC, and that way it can't do the changeover and synchronize things to the cloud on you. I've been avoiding, I've thought about this on a couple of occasions, this whole how to use OneDrive properly, and I've been avoiding it because I think every time I sort of start down that road, I go, oh, crap, and then there's this. it's not easy. Leo has some good information about that. I should at least point to his videos. Yeah,
he's a real fan of OneDrive.
Well, he says it's fine as long as you know what it's doing and you take control of it. There's nothing inherently wrong with it. It's just the way that it was implemented that people are using it and they don't know they're using it and they don't know how to stop using it. That's where the problem really comes. If you know what it's doing, it's okay. I mean, it's cloud storage.
As long as Microsoft let you keep knowing what you're doing with it, that's the problem.
Yeah, exactly.
Another one of these issues where in Microsoft at its finest, right?
That's the trouble with Microsoft.
Even they don't know what they're doing.
Just another comment about that OneDrive. If you have got the Microsoft login and it's there, you can access it via the R-Clone browser, and that way you avoid going into it using Microsoft's own utilities. You still uses the storage as a cloud storage.
Right.
But the R-Clone browser will also access the Google Drive and Dropbox.
Darlene, I see your question on there about how to get them back off the cloud. As a minimum, email me and I will get you the Leo Ask Leo video to you that can give you some information on it. It's a multi-step process to do to make sure you don't lose any data, but it can be done. So email me and I'll be happy to send you that link, and maybe I'll try and get next week at least a link to Leo's videos in Q&A for next Wednesday.
Okay. All right. Thanks very much, everyone. Chris, next is yours too.
Yes, indeed. And so this is just a fascinating thing I found from Brian Krebs, who's a security blogger, quite a clever guy. And he has this just a few days ago. He had this story about DDoS botnet, Esuru. And so for anybody who doesn't know, DDoS stands for Distributed Denial of Service, where compromised computers out on the Internet are directed to just flood, you know, a particular IP address or site with data preventing any legitimate traffic from going on. And so basically the victim gets wiped off the Internet for a period of time. A botnet is a collection of those compromised devices that are under control of the people that are doing the attacking. So the interesting thing about Esuru is it's the most disruptive botnet to date, and it was clocked at nearly 30 trillion bits of data per second being aimed at one target. And there's estimated to be over 300,000 devices in the botnet. Most of them weren't actually computers. They were routers, security cameras, things like that that are using outdated firmware, insecure firmware, or factory default settings with factory default passwords and, you know, things like that. Some attacks have been directed at service providers. This is kind of fascinating, with the goal of forcing them to purchase DDoS protection services that they controlled. So, you know, somebody gets wiped off the Internet because they don't have any protection from DDoS attacks. They decide, oh, okay, I got attacked. I better go buy some DDoS protection out there, which I assume is probably not cheap. And so they happen to buy it from the attackers. And so they're paying a protection racket, basically. So I found it to be a really interesting story. It's the URL is there. It's worth the read for anybody who's into that sort of stuff. And so a follow-on to that, I mean, anytime we talk about DDoS attacks and things like that, and the fact that your computer can be part of that botnet that is attacking others out on the Internet. So don't be part of the problem. So keep your devices up to date. If it's a computer, make sure you have up to date on the security patches. Make sure you use antivirus. Make sure you use the firewall. And if you want to listen to me drone on for 2 hours about it, I give a Protecting Your PC presentation at the Ottawa Public Library, and there are two sessions that are coming up in this fall series. Now, if you have things like routers and Internet of Things devices like thermostats and smart light bulbs and anything else, make sure you keep the firmware up to date if you can. Change default passwords if you can. And where it's possible, limit the Internet connectivity and features so that they are not likely to be used as part of an attack. And yes, cell phones can be part of that. And so keep up to date. Consider a cell phone really to be like a computer. So keep up to date on your updates. Use antivirus on there. Make sure you use the firewall that's built into the phone. And that's all.
I can't be part of that at the moment, but I saw a very troubling report on YouTube today. I meant to make a slide on it. Basically, Google standards are they're going to shut out sideloading options. So they're going to require that all developers of Android software that can be loaded on a cell phone are registered with Google.
Wow.
That's coming in next year, maybe. At least that's the I've only seen one report of that, but it sounds pretty bad. As a software developer, of course, I have a very special app that points to the OPC website, and if you click on the app, it loads the homepage for the website. I guess you won't be able to sideload that anymore.
I guess not.
Oh, yeah, I've seen that too, and there's a lot of uproar about it because it means that, for example, alternative sources of Android software like F-Droid would be entirely put out of business unless everyone registers, including F-Droid. And that's not what people want to do. They don't want to be tied down and paying money to Google to give away free stuff.
Yeah, that was the problem, yeah. Okay, well, more on that later on, maybe. Okay, for now, I've got a follow-up to Chris's botnet thing here. One of the recent issues from Explaining Computers was this YouTube video on desktop security for Linux systems. Now, actually, this is of interest to me, but in general, if you're using Linux, it's a worthwhile look. But in general, it's useful because all the things he talked about are things that we should be doing for Windows machines as well. And his main topics were, you really don't have any security unless you have a good backup system. And he calls it 3-2-1 backups, which are done regularly. And 3-2-1 means you have three copies of your system, and you have them on two different media, and at least one of them is kept off-site in case of fire or burglary or whatever. And if you don't know about backups, then I think in one of the slides that's coming up, you'll find that Chris is doing his backup presentation at one of the library branches, maybe tomorrow. Anyway, it's coming up fairly soon. If you don't know about backups and you don't do them, I highly recommend going to see Chris's presentation. Next thing was to maintain your security patches. So for Windows 10, that you can't update your 11, register for the ESU program, for example, and make sure you have patches coming in regularly. Running a firewall is a good idea. You have a firewall almost certainly in your router, a hardware firewall, but it doesn't hurt to have a software firewall on all of the devices that are connected to it. You should probably run antivirus software if you're using Windows, but Chris Barnett in this video says you probably don't need it for Linux, and he doesn't use antivirus on Linux regularly, and I don't use antivirus on Linux regularly. I mean, I do all of these other things that we're talking about, and so I try to avoid downloading malware. But the fact is, the biggest market share of computing is Windows. So the biggest target for virus writers is Windows. Linux kind of gets left out of that. So you probably don't need antivirus software on a Linux system, but I think you really should have it on Windows. And you've got Windows Defender is built into Windows, and it's a pretty good antivirus product as far as I'm concerned. Effective user account management. This is this business of using a local account rather than an admin account, because local users, regular users, can't do certain things. So it makes it harder for hackers to install malware if they're not really allowed to. And clearly that's a very specific thing to Linux and Unix systems, but the same can apply to Windows. And personally, I always use a regular account on my Windows and only use admin when I actually have to. And the final thing I think we all know about and we all should be doing, he calls it appropriate user behavior. Be careful what you install. Be careful how you install it in terms of admin privileges, sudo for Linux. Don't click on links that you don't know about. Don't download attachments, or don't open attachments that you really don't know where they're coming from. Use strong passwords. Use two-factor authentication. Consider using a VPN in certain circumstances. And if you have sensitive data on your system, it's a good idea to stick it in an encrypted container. So all of those things I think we've talked about here many times, and Chris has got this ongoing series of things at the library which touch on a whole bunch of those. So there's a good source of information for you. Okay, next up, Chris.
Yeah, so this is something that we had a board meeting just on Monday night, and this came out of there. There had been some interest expressed at, in particular when we had our pizza party and things like that, where people were interested in perhaps having additional get-togethers rather than having everything over Zoom. And so we are now proposing a social get-together. So we're proposing for Wednesday, November 26th, starting at 7 p.m., the location being Big Rig Restaurant and Bar, I think they call it, or something like that, in the Gloucester Center, which is in the East End. I put in the link to the, and I don't have it really handy, so I'll paste it in later on, unless somebody else grabs it. Actually, I can get it here right now. Let me just do that just before I forget. And there it is. So there's a map on Google for it, and it's really easy to get to. That's one of the reasons why we chose that particular location. If you're driving, it's if you get off the 174 at the Blair exit, go north, and then it'll just be a little bit west as you get up to Ogilvy. Just that mall on that corner is where it is. And if you happen to want to take the O train, well, the Blair station stops right at the Gloucester Center. Plus, there's plenty of free parking. We chose this one in the East End because the last social event we had was the pizza party in the West End. And if it's successful, we may plan a spring event similar to this that will be more westerly, maybe central or in the West End of the city. That's yet to be determined, of course. So the user group will make the arrangements, so we will book space in the Big Rig. I've already talked to them. As long as they get notice a week in advance, they say there'd be no problem. We did pick the Wednesday night, by the way, because we figured that a lot of the people are already coming to Q&As or regular meetings on Wednesday nights, so it's more likely that a Wednesday night will be good for everybody. So
actually, it's only because Chris and I wanted the night off.
Yeah, that's right. So we're going to have a poll. And it's going to be repeated next week just to catch more potential attendees before we make our final decision. If you're here this week and you vote and you see it next week, don't vote again. So just vote once. Not critical, but we just really want to capture the idea of how many people are really interested in attending. So if enough people are interested, there will be an email that will go out on the announcement list, which most members are they're signed up for that. And non-members are welcome to attend as well. So the message will go out with more details about it on that. It probably is going to be there probably one newsletter as well. So it'll be announced in the next newsletter in all likelihood as well. So I'm going to bring up the poll right now. And there's the poll. You should see it on screen. Tell me if you're not seeing it.
We are, yes.
Okay. And go ahead and vote. I'll leave it up there on screen for a while. So basically, you know, yeah, definitely you're going to make it, or yes, probably, or not likely, or definitely no. And we'll just let it go. We've got 19 people voted so far, and we've got 41 on the call. So I'll leave it up for a little bit more. If there's anybody has any questions about it, by all means, you can send it in to either me or the suggestion box mailbox, and somebody will respond to you about it. But we really don't have much else other than what I've already talked about so far. And it seems to have slowed down with 32 of 32 responses.
32, 39, is this?
Sorry?
32, 39.
Okay. Okay, and so I will end the poll now, I think, and share the results. And so everybody can look at that.
20, so about half.
Yeah.
About half, yes.
Yeah. Well, I think if 20 people showed up, it would certainly be worth us actually carrying through with it. So I suspect that it will actually happen. But we will throw up the poll again next week and see if we get some additional people before we make the final decision. So, with that, I will turn it back to Alan.
Okay, thank you very much, Chris. And I'm actually going to turn it over to Tom, because Tom has got to share for us on the Swift internal suite of applications.
Okay, just a sec, I have to give Tom, I didn't want to deprive Tom the right to vote, and co-hosts can't vote on polls. So, okay, Tom, you are now co-host.
You need to unmute.
Okay, let me share my screen after I start my thing. And I want, of course, let's, well, that doesn't help. Okay. This is the one I want to share.
Started screen sharing.
There we go.
Hello.
Okay, so internals. This is internals medicine. So SysInternals is a, it was originally a project by a guy who then went to work for Microsoft, a consultant, and then Microsoft took it over, and so it's now kind of part of what Microsoft supports. And it's a bunch of programs to do stuff inside of Windows. Most of it's more useful to developers, but some of it's useful to ordinary people too. So it's basically utilities for networking, file and disk, other, processing and security, other being other than the other stuff. So for networking, there are some examples here, ShareEnum, TCP view to show all your TCP connections, remote tools for handling other computers in your network, Whois, Pipelist, and that kind of stuff. There are also some file and disk utilities, Contig, if you want to make a file contiguous. And if you have a hard disk, then it probably helps you to have a file being contiguous. In other words, it's all together in one place instead of being at the beginning of the disk or far down the disk, because it reduces the amount of movement by the disk arm that reads the disk. Disk monitor, if you want to look at your what is happening on your disk, you can move files. This is good for things that you can't move ordinarily, and you only want to move them on when you boot up before they're actually tied down. Disk usage, cache set, you can control your file access caching, and synchronization, how fast, how soon, and so on. And processing, auto runs, process explorer, I'll be getting into these. Process monitor, you can see what a process is doing and monitor it in real time. You can also run a program as a different user. You don't have to sign on as them, but you can actually run it as a different user. And security, checking access authorities or changing them, revealing a rootkit, which is basically somebody, a virus that is bugging you that in a very hidden away place. Secure delete, and share enumeration, which is to see what files are being shared and where on your network. So some of these, again, are more useful for people in networks of computers. So here are the process utilities with a short thing about them, auto runs, handle, etc. And again, most of them are useful if you're actually debugging a program, but two of them we're going to look into. This one, auto runs, and process monitor, because those are useful to ordinary people. Auto runs, these are all the programs that run automatically. They could run at login, they could run on a schedule, they could run when you turn the computer on. You can see all these things here. These are the tabs for different pieces that run automatically. For example, you can have a macro that runs automatically when you start Office. You probably don't, but you might, and you might want to. Known DLLs that are available to programs that run boot execution, codecs, which translate, make it possible for you to run, to see movies and so on that are coded in a certain way, drivers, services, and so on. And there is one thing for everything. So this is, these are auto runs that are in my computer. My computer, by the way, is called Missing. If you see Missing something here, that's my computer. So things like Amazon Music, NVIDIA Broadcast, Pegasus Mail, and so on. And let's go on to an example. Here are auto-run actions that you can do as an administrator. You can, if you right-click on a particular program, you can delete it. That deletes it from the your disk or your SSD. You can it deletes it from the auto run, so it doesn't run ever again. But you can also uncheck it. For example, there are check marks here, and these don't have check marks, so they're here and they're in the registry, which is where most of this stuff is. But they're not going to be activated. So CCleaner isn't going to be activated, but GlassWire is, Google Drive is, HD Sentinel is. And so you can uncheck the entry. You can delete the entry from the registry or wherever it is. You can jump to other entries. You can submit it to VirusTotal. If we go back, you'll see there's a VirusTotal column here. And it shows that, for example, here for HD Sentinel, one of the 77 antivirus programs recognized it as a virus, which is probably an error. The same thing for OpenDNS Updater and run pop file. ShareX is recognized as zero. So you can actually automatically submit it. For example, if you're wondering about a particular thing that's running, you can submit it right to VirusTotal. Creates the hash that VirusTotal expects, and then it sends the hash to VirusTotal, and then VirusTotal decides that whether it's seen it or not. You can open Process Explorer for the process to look into details of the process. You can search it online. You can find other stuff within the entries, and you can look at the individual properties of a particular process or file in this case. Process Explorer is like Task Manager on steroids. You can see all of your processes. These little white things at the beginning show kind of where a particular thing started and when they're the same name. So these are actually things that actually got started. Amazon Photos, Auto Hotkey. All of these programs are started, and as well as kind of showing all these things, and there's a lot of information you can decide to show. You can set the columns, and in here, these are fields for the process image that are put in these columns. But there are lots of other things you can choose, such as the version, the image path, control flow guard, stack protection, Windows status, what session it's in. What was the command line? You can see the command line that started it, the VirusTotal, and so on. All of these you can choose to put in the columns in the overall display. And there are lots of these fields. This is just for the fields for the process image. But you can also, there are fields for process performance. There are fields for .NET connections. Microsoft.NET is the way Microsoft does networking, status bar, DLLs, handles, which are file handles, that's the one that's being accessed, process I/O, process GPU, and process, I'm not sure what that is. and if you go back here, here are some of the examples of IO, IO delta read, IO delta write. Delta means it's a difference. So it's been, this is set to reinitialize or it actually measured, does all the measurements every 10 seconds. So these are the measurements for 10 seconds. So this is a, this particular process, Amazon Photos read 92 megabytes of data in the last 10 seconds, and it wrote 7.7 megabytes of data. Delta other, this is usually networking. So, for example, this is Chrome, so it did 45 kilobytes of stuff that it sent off to the network or received. It wrote locally 62 kilobytes, and it read 85 kilobytes. So those are all the things you can choose to put in the display. When you do the properties, you, of course, you get all of these things for the particular process. The actions you can do are interesting. You can set affinity. That means that you can say that this process can only start up on this particular CPU. That's what the affinity is. Priority, you can choose a variety of priorities. Normal is 8. You should never choose real time. That's really, if anything is, has real time, it does not stop until it's, it decides to stop. Other things can be superseded. But I often change priority here. For Amazon Photos, I've changed priority to be background. Normal is 8, below normal is 6. But you can use this to give priority to something that you're interested in having more priority over everything else that's in the computer. And usually above normal is enough. You can kill the process. You can restart the process. You can debug the process, which I have never done. You can create a dump so you can actually see what's in the process, all the data, all the instructions in machine language. You can check Barbis total for a particular process if you haven't done it already. You can see all the properties for it, and you can search it online if you're wondering what something is. So there's a lot of disk utilities. These are the file and disk utilities. Access check, again, that's kind of security, access enumeration. Cache set helps to control the cache manager. If you have a lot of memory in your system, you can have a, there's an automatic cache that Windows creates, and cache set will allow you to set how much memory to use for a cache. Comptig, which I explained earlier, disk to VHD, if you want to do virtual machines, that may help. And there are a lot of other things, junctions, basically creating a link to a data so you can have the same data being referenced as two different file names, but that's what a junction is. A PS file, these are remote things, secure delete and so on. These are all things that access files and disks. Security utilities, access checks, well, these are, again, are kind of fit in several different things. Auto logon, you can specify, you can bypass the password screen during logon if you trust everybody in your home, including the burglars, Process Explorer, et cetera, et cetera. There are a lot of other things, including a feature called Zoom It, which allows you to zoom into things and enlarge them for presentations and so on. And it also has a handy break timer, which counts down from whatever, however many minutes you want. And it shows on the screen so that if you, when you leave for a break, they know when it's gonna, when the break is going to end, if you're doing a presentation. So there's a lot of other things, Not My Fault, NTFS Info, Page Defrag. Again, Page Defrag, for example, is like Comptig, but it's for the page file. The paging file is what Microsoft uses for virtual memory so that you can actually have programs that are larger than the memory in your machine, and it goes, and the extra stuff goes into the page file. and it goes back and forth. And so it pages back and forth, and it's called pages because NTFS treats and Windows treats 4 kilobyte sections as being pages, and it pages back in 4K sections. And a whole bunch of other things, which you might be interested in, especially if you're a developer. So SysInternals, it has strong tools for managing your computer and diagnosing troubles. Are there any questions?
I don't see any questions. I have a comment from Steve saying suspend is a good way to stop a process. It won't let you delete. I would think maybe trying to kill the process would be good.
It won't let you kill it, though, or stop it. And
yeah.
If you hit the suspend, it'll suspend it.
And oh, that's interesting. Yeah, I'm surprised it would let you suspend it if you can't kill it. But that's a good idea. I never thought of that.
It's sort of a last resort.
Yeah, good idea.
Well, if you Google Windows SysInternals, you'll find it, and you'll find all the tools available. They're available individually, but you can also download a group, a zip file of about, 20 megabytes or so that controls that has everything in it. Then you can pick it out from there. Apparently, you can also run them live. So you can actually not download them to your system, but you can run them live from the web. I've never done that, so I can't make any recommendations on it. So Google SysInternals and Windows, and you'll find it.
And I put the link in the chat to the SysInternals site as well.
Okay, well, thanks very much. Thanks very much, Tom. And next up, I think we have some different utilities, Chris.
Yeah, this is I came across this just recently, and it's really kind of interesting. It's really quirky. 54 tiny little utilities that are available, and you don't need to install them. They're all portable apps, so you just unzip the file, run the program, and away you go. Now, one caution on it, a lot of them seem to be flagged as being malicious at VirusTotal. To me, the only AV engines at VirusTotal that flagged them as malicious were really obscure engines. There were none of the mainstream ones thought it was malicious. It's a good idea to, if you are suspicious at all, read the privacy policy, and it talks about AV engines and so forth in there. To me, the heavy-duty evidence on it indicates they are all safe to use. So. Some, I think, are totally needless. They have a PDF printer. Well, there's one built into Windows. Just use that. Palos, take control back in Windows. Already the options are in settings to do what this does. Various ones. Tryon, serial port terminal. Is anybody still using serial ports? Well, if you are, okay, but not many people are doing that. Limit CD-ROM speed. Do you really want to limit the speed of your CD-ROM? I don't know. Anyhow, there were a bunch that were like that. But I thought that a lot of them were handy. Homedale, this was the reason I turned on to as the development was from the last monthly meeting where it was all about Wi-Fi. And the speaker talked about Homedale. And it's actually not a bad Wi-Fi monitor. And there's other ones, setting screen resolution for each user. Under Windows, normally, the screen resolution that you set will affect all users on that computer. Well, you can actually have it that as you log on, it will adjust to whatever screen resolution you want. That could be handy. And about a bunch of other ones there. So I highly recommend that people check them out and see if there's anything in that list that strikes your fancy.
Yeah, that Homedale that was demonstrated last time, I asked them if there was a way to force the Wi-Fi to run at 6 gigahertz. And if you use the Homedale, you can. Because
cool.
You can actually see from the channels what frequency they're running at. So the 5 gigahertz band, depending on what the channel number is, steps up and up to like 5.87, I think, was the highest I seen. So you should be able to actually force it to be 6 gigahertz, even in the 5 gigahertz band.
just by selecting the right channel.
Richard, you have your hand up.
Yes, a big thank you, Chris. I've been looking for something to turn off all these background processes, and that auto-run utility seems to be the thing to do the job.
Oh, yeah. That was in Tom's presentation. The terminals are great utilities. They really are. Mark Rusinovich wrote them. He was the first one to reverse engineer the NTFS file system before he started working for Microsoft.
Yeah, he's a brilliant programmer, that guy. Yeah. They should have him writing Windows and get rid of all the other morons.
And he's a really, really nice guy, too. I've met him, and he's a really nice guy.
Okay. When it comes down to security, that's those background processes, and there could be dozens of them.
Yeah, exactly.
Lots of different programs from lots of different places. Any of them potentially could be compromised. So I think that's where Windows really has got its security risks, not so much from virus downloads. And some of the big Windows security happenings have been because of these background processes.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, we're going to move on. I've got a follow-up here to a question from 2 weeks ago, actually from Richard, our Australian friend here. When Bob gave his presentation about the Everything search utility for Windows, and I highly recommend Everything, and I highly recommend Bob's presentation if you didn't see it, Richard asked whether there was an equivalent for Linux. And, of course, there's always an equivalent in Linux. And the closest one, I think, is called F-Search, File Search. And this is developed by I think he's Austrian. He really liked the Everything software, but he couldn't find an equivalent on Linux that did searches as quickly and was also as powerful in terms of its search features. And he wanted, in particular, something that was a standalone application. It had to be fast, so he says C-like performance, C being the programming language, noted for producing fast software, and something with a small footprint, so something not terribly huge. Since he couldn't find it, he wrote his own, and it's available on GitHub. Now, it's a Linux application. Remember, we're looking for a Linux equivalent to Everything. And the installation is a bit tricky. It's not, you can't do it through the software manager. You have to do it with all kinds of wonderful things. It's an open source app. It's released under the general public license. It's available for multiple distributions, multiple versions of Linux. And just like Everything, it's basically instant. As you type, it shows you results. You can use wildcards. You can use regular expressions. You can filter for searching for files or folders or both. You can include or exclude specific folders that you want to be searched. And you can sort by things like file name, path, size, time, that kind of thing. So here's the GitHub page, where you can find the software. And when you download and install it and run it, the first thing that happens is you get this splash screen, and it says that the database is empty, and it wants you to add folders. So you have to tell it, what do you want it to search? And in my case, all my data files are on my data disk, dedicated data drive. So I give it the Linux mount point for that drive and say OK. And instantly, it fills up with a bunch of files. Some of them are not terribly useful to me, so what I need to do is go into the search box here, and maybe what I want to do is look for all of my PowerPoint files, all of my PPTX files. And you can see there's a bunch right here which are in the recycle bin, interestingly enough. But you can also see I've got some in my OPCUD presentations file. There's something down here in an ATIP file and some other stuff. So it's found all of my PPTX files, but let's sort of drill down a bit closer and look for things that have got a prefix of 2025-10, which is basically the way that Chris tells me what files he's sending me. And you can see here, here for example, is his share on the botnet, and here's the one on Huxley, and some of the other ones are, he says, whenever. So we're going to see some of these things later on. But basically, that's everything for Linux. It's called fsearch, and it's really a neat program. I think we're just about over the magic number, so we've had lots of discussion, and why does it do that all of a sudden? We've had lots of discussion on these various things, so let me go straight to the library presentations, which Chris is going to give, Chris and Linda are going to give. Keeping passwords safe, so password managers, that's actually the one that is tomorrow at Rosemount. Linda's going to be talking about Newfoundland on Saturday the 25th. And there's that little backup presentation that I highly recommend if you need to know anything about backup and backup strategies. I just remind you that this is just a sampling of the sessions that are available. You click on this link, you will go to them all. If you want to attend one of them, then you need to go to this site and basically register for the session with the library. They handle all that kind of stuff. So thanks everyone for attending tonight. Thanks to Tom for that share on sysinternals. Great graphics, by the way. And next week will be our next Q&A session, October 22nd, next Wednesday. If you have questions, if you have answers to things that we've talked about or topics that you'd like to share, if you just send us a brief note of what you want, what it is you want, to suggestion box at opcug.ca, and Chris and I will be the proud recipients of that message, and we'll do our best to assist you in any way you wish. So again, thanks for attending tonight, and I'll see you next Wednesday.
Alan, one comment?
Go ahead. Yeah, sorry, I didn't see your hand up this time.
Yeah. Just a recommendation from people from Brookdale user group. They have, if you must have Windows 11, they were running it under Linux in a virtual machine, and they obtained the actual license key to put into the Windows 11 in that virtual machine. And once it was running, they said it went through and it updated. It took in the Windows updates. So if you must have Windows 11, that must be the way to do it.
Okay, where did you get the key from?
Well, he bought the key off the web. I think he paid $10 for it.
One of these third-party resellers, yeah. Okay, thanks, Richard. So see you next Wednesday, everyone.